whether the United States is rich enough to be able to make sure that everyone has a basic right to health care, family leave, parental, sick leave. We are exceptional. Whether we are a society that can tolerate, that should tolerate the levels of inequality that we have, I think Bernie Sanders is right about that. And I think that we, Hillary is right that we, one of the strengths of America should be that we can give opportunity for small businesses. Actually, Denmark and Norway do that as well. So there, what I would say is that Bernie is absolutely right that the providing the basic necessities of a middle-class society should be the right of everybody in our country.
Nobel Prize-winning economist Joe Stiglitz, author of the new book, Rewriting the Rules of the American Economy, An Agenda for Growth and Shared Prosperity. To see part one of our conversation, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is hiring a development director to lead our fundraising efforts and an on-air graphics operator. We're also accepting applications for our internship program. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karens, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with our host, Joanne Hardesty. Today's guest is Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Oregon. We'll talk about the recent police killing of a mentally ill man in Portland and why the Department of Justice intervention hasn't even slowed down the rate of police killings of our citizenry.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of MAMI, an art exhibit at Yale Union in Portland. MAMI is a group show that considers the mystery and chaos of motherhood, and in reaction to the sentimentality and laments the culturally constructed binary of, quote, family versus career, while acknowledging the persistence of that obstacle in the lives of artists. Again, that's MAMI, showing Thursday through Sunday, 3 to 6 p.m. until December 20th at Yale Union, located at 800 Southeast 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons. It bankrupts schools and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KBOO News Director Jenka Soderberg in a panel discussion on People versus ALEC. Again, that's a film and talk to learn about ALEC on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am pleased to have here in the studio with me Jason Renault, who you may know from the Mental Health Association of Oregon, as well as being part of the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, longtime community activist. Good morning, Jason.
Good
welcome.
Good morning, Joanne.
It's so great to have you here.
Thanks
I'm so
having.
Sorry that we're having the conversation that we're going to have. So we're going to have this conversation today because, was it last week or 2 weeks ago now, Michael Johnson was shot and killed outside of Good Samaritan Hospital by Portland police officers. That is the fourth, I believe. Is that right?
Third
this year of a person with mental health in mental health crises being killed at the hands of the police. As you may know, that Portland Police Bureau was investigated by the Department of Justice starting in 2010 and 2011. They did the investigation in 2012. Their findings stated that Portland police, in fact, used excessive force against people with mental health issues or people perceived to have mental health issues. And we have been spending money at a rapid rate to correct the deficiencies in Portland Police Bureau to address how they interact and engage with people with mental health issues. Now, I want to start by saying that when I heard that the medical examiner ruled Michael Johnson's death a suicide, I was horrified that that would be allowed to be placed on an official document because the official cause of death is homicide. So is this the first time that that's happened, or is this the continuation of a trend of using police language to justify shooting people who are in crisis?
Well, there are the state has four ways that you can define death. And those five, excuse me, natural death, a homicide, an accidental death, such as in the death of James Chassie, a suicide, or the fifth is a rarely used in Oregon, it's legal intervention, that the state has taken a life. And in Oregon, the coroner has decided, has made a decision within the coroner's office to use the term legal intervention to only mean the death penalty. So she does not use that designation for anything other than the death penalty, and it is it's to sort of adjust to national statistics around the death penalty, rather than to cover up anything for the police. But the issue with Michael Johnson is that he didn't take any action against himself. He
no.
did not
right.
harm himself, and
right.
he was not. Though the police say he was suicidal, and they say that he was speaking to them and negotiating, so they may have some other information that we'll learn later from the district attorney and the internal investigation. He did not take any action against himself in this suicide.
So it just boggles the mind to think that you would label that suicide and not actually, what would you call it, murder?
Well,
homicide.
Homicide is the typical charge. What it does do is stigmatize the event and say that this was an action of where actually the victim killed themselves.
Right.
It's blaming the victim for the actions of the police and blaming, again, a person with mental illness
yes.
who was in crisis,
yes.
literally at the doorstep of a hospital
right.
for their death.
And so this is not, as you've mentioned, this is the third case that we've had this year. The case just before this, there was a gentleman also outside of a hospital that was brandishing a knife.
Well, that's Merle Hatch, and that's back in 2013. And Merle Hatch had been trying to get into the hospital to get care for his he was in a, having a drug overdose, and was pretty hysterical and dangerous because of that drug overdose. Mm-hmm. The security guard escorted him out into the parking lot where the police confronted him, and he lost his life in the parking lot. The three in 2015 are Chris Healy, who died out in the Troutdale area, and we have some connections to Mr. Healy. He came from Pennsylvania by Greyhound bus after having a schizophrenic episode. We talked to his family, and was killed by the police as he was clearly lost and a little bit psychotic and trying to he woke up in a friend's home, didn't know where he was, and went outside and tried to get back in, and went back into a neighbor's house, and that caused the police to arrive. The second person, most recent, was killed in June, and that was Alan Bellew. And Alan was a person resident of Salem who had come up for unknown reasons and was a longtime methamphetamine addict and was also in a what we would define as a mental health crisis when the police killed him.
Right. So what we know is that normally after an incident, a high profile, and I would say that the two that we've just talked about, Chris Healy and Alan Bellew, did I say that right, Bellew?
I think it's Bellew.
Bellew. Are cases that are on the front page one day and then you don't really hear much about it after that. But normally after high profile cases, like after the death of James Chassie and after the death of Aaron Campbell, Portland police immediately starts, we're going to change the training. We're going to change policy. We're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. Why does it keep happening over and over and over again? If we retrain officers, if we've got the Department of Justice actually looking, breathing down their neck to make them not be aggressive in their interaction with people with mental health issues, why is it that this still becomes 3 to 4 to 5 per year that happen in Oregon to people from our community?
Well, that's a good question. Just to start at the top, we have looked at all of the public record of all the deaths caused by police in the Portland area going back to the early 70s, and it is about 3 persons per year on average, year after year. There's really been no dip in the number of lethal interventions since the training began after the death of Nathan Thomas in the early 1990s. So wow. We've been training police officers around mental health crisis for now decades.
Right.
And there's been no change in the
outcomes.
In the outcome. And the police say that there is a dip, a recent dip, in the amount of what they call use of force.
Right.
And maybe also a dip in the amount of use of force against people with mental illness. Unfortunately, the police aren't able to share that data with the public because their database can't produce an actual report.
Right, right. This is what we found out when the latest status report was produced, that this fancy computer system that's supposed to be the early warning system actually doesn't talk to the other data systems. And so they've been saying for a long time that use of force has been going down, yeah. But they can't prove it. So are we supposed to just take their word that use of force is going down, even though the number of deaths are not going down?
Well, I have one of these computer systems in my shop, and it doesn't work either. We've spent millions of dollars trying to. I have great sympathy for the police, but until they can get it to work, no, right. We can't take their word for it. And what we can take is the public record, which is 3 deaths per year.
Yes. We're going to go to the phone line. Good morning, Joanne. Welcome to KBOO.
Yes. Hello, Joanne.
Hi.
Hi, Joanne.
Haven't called me, Joanne, but I understand. And people are not schizophrenic. They're in mental pain. And also, I know what's going on, Joanne. You're preparing for your 2020 presidential campaign. And maybe then, if you get to be president, you can really do something about prisons and the police and the mental health system. And thank you for listening.
Thank you, Joanne. And I am going to call you. Have a good day.
That was from last week.
Yeah, that was last week. We have another caller. Hello, Camilo. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am a retired psychiatrist. I'm not from Oregon originally. I'm from New York, so I'm not really fully knowledgeable about the system here. But I'm a healthcare reform advocate. And one of the reforms that I believe in is that if we had single payer, we would have much greater access. And I think if the people that you're discussing today had had greater access to mental health care, perhaps these disasters would not occur. And I would like to ask your guests to comment about that.
Thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think that that's the factor that we haven't adjusted in the last dozen years or so. We have put a lot of energy into repairing the police, but we haven't put any energy into repairing the mental health system. The sad part about this is that the reform effort that's mandated by the Department of Justice repairs a system that we all know doesn't work.
Right.
And so at the end of this 5 years of
experiment,
locked into reform,
right,
we will have a system that was basically designed in the early 1960s and is dependent on medications and big hospitals. So I'm not optimistic.
Well, neither am I at this point, but I do think that it is important to highlight that clearly, the training that we're doing is not sufficient to change how police interact and engage with people on the street. What we know is that the way the training has been set up is that they only bring in people with lived mental health experience to serve on a panel. Right? Like the first day of training, or they'll have a panel. But most of the training is still done by police officers, which is a huge mistake, because even the Department of Justice has suggested that they need to integrate people with lived mental health experience into the training curriculum so that they are ongoing parts of the training. But I think it's not just mental health lived experience, but it's lived experience, period, right? How are you going to train community police officers without the community?
I think that's very important, and that's one of the problems with the police training that we've criticized, is that after the death of James Chassis, the police department did a major remodeling of their training. And what they did was they removed those persons with lived experience from the training process.
Yes.
And so, and by lived experience, that really means for us people with mental illness who have had encounters with the police, mm-hmm. either positive or negative, who can come and speak about those.
That's right.
But what would also be very beneficial for this training is to speak to people who are vulnerable in other ways,
yes.
and feel vulnerable to the police,
yes.
and feel intimidated by police action. And I think really especially young people of color need to speak more openly and loudly to police officers.
Which is just the opposite of what we teach them.
But in a safe room,
yes.
where police officers are listening and learning.
Yes, yes. I absolutely agree with that. If you want to join the conversation, I am talking to Jason Renault. He is with the Mental Health Association of Oregon, as well as a member of the AMA Coalition for Police Reform. Justice and Police Reform. That's the first time I've got the name wrong. Most people mess it up constantly. Back to the phone line. Rebel. Good morning, Rebel. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. On this police training, is just an excuse. The DOJ used that excuse across the country to quell the public and get them to be quiet, to get them to calm down, get them to sweep the issue under the carpet. We all know that our government is corrupt, and what we're viewing in all this is the corruption revealing itself. And it's revealing itself all over the country because it's a systemic issue. And it actually even goes beyond the country. It goes global. And, you know, we see police forces in China, in Hong Kong, acting the same way to protesters as the U.S. government does, while the U.S. government says that people have the right to protest. So what we're dealing with here is corruption at the highest level, training is just another money grab for them to get more funding for their weapons and their oppression. And it disempowers the people. The police never pay. The public is always the one that pays with our tax dollars. When the city gets sued for $6 million, guess who pays? The people. The police don't pay. And I think you remember the call that you had the other day. I can't remember your name. Oh, I'm sorry. Celeste?
Yeah, Joanne.
Oh, Joanne, I think you remember the call about that health professional the other day where they have strict standards about malpractice and they have to carry their own insurance.
Yes.
And if they mess up, they pay, not the people. The people don't pay. So that's what we're dealing with here. And any of this training, blah, 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 the reason why you're not seeing results is because it's a lie. It's just a cover for the corruption that's bleeding out everywhere. And that's what we're witnessing. And I'm going to hang up now. Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. Well, there's a lot to agree with about what Rebel said. I certainly think that it's become clear to me that reform is not the priority within Portland Police Bureau. It's pretty much maintaining the status quo. And I've been really disappointed that we haven't seen the significant change. I actually thought that having the DOJ come to town would actually be significant enough to really push the change that the community's been seeking. And I'm not seeing that happen.
No, clearly Rebel is expressing the point of view of a lot of people that it's not just the events that aren't going down, but the trust isn't being rebuilt.
And, no.
And that's really an essential tool of police work is community trust. It's as essential as the law and the uniform and the gun is to have the trust. So when an officer tells a young person to stop,
right. That
young person says, I trust that this officer isn't going to shoot me.
Right.
And they stop.
Right.
Because otherwise, if they run, then trouble's going to happen.
Right.
And that trust it's very dangerous to leave that unrepaired.
It's absolutely true, but yet we hear constantly about all these trust-building activities that the police are involved in. And in fact, this Friday's City Club Forum is focused on violence in Portland, and I'm very fearful that that program is going to be focused on those really bad black gang kids that are running rampant in our city. I found it interesting in Cop Watch magazine that I found a startling number. There were like 20 shootings, 20 gun incidents in a 3-month period of time. Of course, most of the headlines always start with gang when they're shooting in the title. Ironically, only one of those, after the cases had been concluded, ultimately ended up being a gang-affiliated shooting, right? And so when the police immediately frame it for the public. A shooting happened, the gang enforcement unit's going out, which is the very worst trained unit in the Portland Police Bureau because they couldn't find a gang member if their life depended on it. So the way this process is set up, it is really, it's really clear that we have not done the fundamental changes in our training program and the engagement with the community that we need to. So this program Friday at City Club, Antoinette Edwards is going to be talking about the snitch program that they've developed, because that's why we're not solving crime, because the community's not snitching on each other. She's going to talk about that and really frame it from a City of Portland perspective, which I find really troubling.
Mm-hmm, yeah. As a community member and a resident of North Portland for the last 30 years, I can't find those gang members either.
Yeah.
They are elusive. And I think when you get to the conviction stage, you're not finding convictions of gang participation.
No.
You're finding possession of controlled substance.
Yes.
and traffic violations.
Right.
And you know, a person not supposed to have a gun. These are not gangs. These are teenagers.
Right.
You know,
you can't get more money by just saying you got teenagers acting like teenagers, right?
There's federal grants out there to be got.
Right. They're not federal grants for, let's just engage in community dialogue with teenagers. We're going to go back to the phone line. We've got them lined up. Good morning, Brian. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing? And I'm at the head of the line.
Well, of course.
Finally, you know. So, you know, what I have, and I don't want to offend your guest at all, but, you know, basically, you know, with all your knowledge and all your background and, you know, all your suggestions and everything else, the only thing we're doing out here is we're counting the dead. And, you know, that's all we're doing. You know, the police are going to continue to operate the way they are and until there's some significant changes. And, you know, I really honestly believe at this point that it's time to start charging, you know, our police force with their crimes. And, I mean, you know, seriously doing it. You know, I've repeated this for years. We have an avowed Nazi in the police force who was in the training facility. Now he's what, the head of ICE, this Kruger gentleman?
Oh yeah, Kruger, and his record's clean now because the mayor actually just signed off on just erasing his record, even though the DOJ said that there's no precedent in the country to actually remove that kind of language from someone's personnel file.
Okay, so, you know, like, I mean, we're not only looking at unethical behavior.
Right.
It's gone beyond that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Portland agrees vehemently with, and I won't call it a conspiracy, but I think there's a consensus in this country for police officers to act against minority communities, you know, and, you know, and this just constant, I mean, gang thing is incredible. I mean, I have yet to see a gang in Portland.
You know, yeah, me
I've
either.
Lived all over the country and in Jamaica. I know what a gang looks like.
Yep.
Okay, you know, I mean, you know, there's no problem seeing them. But you know, the bottom line goes like this. I mean, you know, these people are going to lie and they're not going to be honest with us. Okay, they're not going to ever come. You know, they're not ever going to face the consequences, or they're not even going to acknowledge what they're doing. So, you know, instead of us educated people out here and us as people who know the difference between, you know, reality and disreality, you know, we need to find a way. I don't know that way, but we need to find a way to start charging these people and getting them out of our police force, because in the end, they're wasting all our time and all our money. And guess what? It's our time and our money.
So I agree with you. So now what?
Now what? I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, there was a conglomerate of lawyers back in the 60s, you know, who changed the civil rights movement significantly, along with the people who marched across the bridges and dealt with, you know, sit-ins and fire hoses. There was a whole bunch of lawyers. Where are those lawyers now? I don't know. But, you know, the bottom line goes like this. We are not going to get anywhere speaking to these people because they have proved, I mean, I think they've proved that they just cannot be honest. And they have an agenda that is definitely not in our interest anymore, wouldn't you say?
Well, yes. I certainly would say that it is certainly not in the interest to hold police accountable for bad behavior. We don't have any system in Portland right now to do that. We've got the pretend IPR, which I went to one of the CRC meetings the other day, and I promised never in life will I subject myself to that kind of nonsense again. It's a fake system. So first, we have to get the public to understand that we do not have a system to hold police accountable. We have a system to hold the public accountable, but no system to hold police accountable for inappropriate behavior.
Well,
as the public knows that, then it's like, okay, how do we get accountability?
Right, and you know, getting accountability is passing laws, and actually holding these people accountable. I mean, I don't know any job in that I've ever even known of that where you could actually go out and murder somebody and be at work 2 days later. I just don't know that kind of job. You know, I don't know a job. When I was in the military, I was in from 80 to 84, which wasn't that long ago, okay? But if I walked up to my sergeant and I said, hey, those communists are pretty good people, I would be out of the military in a week.
Let me give you a little response to that.
But, No, I mean, I just want to point this out real quick.
Oh, no.
You know, this guy Kruger can espouse Nazi, you know, philosophy all over the police department, and we're wondering what the problem is. You know, I mean, come on, you know, and I mean, like, that is, in any country, is totally against,
It's crazy. Thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry, I would have.
It's okay, okay. It's fine. Jason wants to jump in here, though, because between you and I, Jason just can't get a word in edgewise.
And Jason, I'll take it off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye. Hey, thanks. There are dozens of layers of accountability, of systems that are providing accountability to the police bureau. They, as Joanne mentioned, they're all different variations of ineffective, but there's lots of opportunity for the public to engage in these processes. I was at a meeting of the DOJ COAB the other night, and public meeting, anybody could come, there's snacks, and there's one member of the public there, just one person, and that person probably just stepped off the street, and he had no idea what the meeting was about, and was doing his gamest to keep... I think there was 5 police officers and a total of 10 people on city payroll there, but only one member of the public.
The public.
So we're still in the phase of the emperor has no clothes.
Right.
And we're gathering people like these callers to get engaged with this process, get knowledgeable, and get down to City Hall and start talking to these people. Because we're in Portland, Oregon. We're not in Chicago where you get the cold shoulder. People really do listen. They really want to make a difference. They don't know how. I wouldn't be in this business if I wasn't optimistic change could occur.
Well, and I want to also remind our listeners that there's a majority of the city council that's up for re-election next year. And there's nothing like being up for re-election to get the ear of a politician. And so I would say, yes, go to the Community Oversight Advisory Board meetings. But more importantly, go to the city council. Get scheduled at those 3 minutes at the beginning of the city council meeting and just pound it into their head that the entire city council is responsible for this broken police department that we have. The entire city council signed off on the settlement agreement. And therefore, the entire city council is responsible for fixing it. And they keep pretending somehow the police commissioner who has given it over to the police department is only the only person that can fix it. Before I go back to the phone line, I want you to know that The Guardian has started counting people killed at the hands of the police across the country, since no one else seems to be interested in the fact that people are being killed all over the United States of America on a daily basis by people who are sworn to protect and serve. And so as of November of 2015, the number is 984 people. That's 984 people who have been killed at the hands of the police in the United States of America. And I appreciate The Guardian starting to keep a tally of these numbers, because until people see numbers like almost 1,000 people so far this year killed at the hands of the police, you can't look at those numbers and not know that there's a problem.
Yeah, there's been a lot of amateur data collection of police deaths, including our organization. We collect all the deaths of people in the state of Oregon. But we don't have the skills or the resources that an agency like The Guardian has. So it really is up to date. It's a great list. We've checked it against our lists. This is where, by pronouncing the emperor has no clothes over and over again, you start to attract these higher resourced individuals and organizations to help.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that the public doesn't know, is that most of the advocates that are working to try to reform the police do it for free, whereas the police has as many resources as they can get their hands on to do what they want to do. And so we're clearly out-resourced, but definitely not out-passioned, because we've been at this for a while. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Betty Lynn. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning, Joanne. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Two things before I hit a taboo that you have not hit but alluded to when speaking of the emperor has new clothes is Joanne's comment that you should run for office. You should, Joanne. There may be more women in politics. I don't know why they're not stepping up.
Are you out in the rain by chance?
No. and I'm on a landline.
Oh, wow. Something really weird is happening with the phone line. It sounds like it's pouring down raining.
I know, but I don't know what it is. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Okay, yeah, keep going. It's fine.
Okay, so the second thing is a taboo that you've only, alluded to with a comment about the emperor has no clothes, and that is that there are some people who provoke police to kill them. And it's a form of assisted suicide.
Well, so let's talk about that, because in my view, that is a police narrative of what happens. Now, if you are a well-trained professional who has been trained specifically in how to reach out and disengage and connect with people who are suffering from mental health issues, then I would think that your very last response would be a weapon, rather than that be your very first response. Think about, let's just do the simple one. How about the guy with the knife? Now, you can disarm someone with a knife. Right? And especially if you are a well-trained professional. You're never going to make me believe that somebody that's coming at you with a knife and you're a well-trained professional, your only option is to shoot them.
So I want to talk about a case that happened about a year and a half ago in Salem. And I know this case because I spoke to the widow. And she said that, yes, her husband had a mental illness and was struggling with that, and that her husband had anger episodes all week,
right,
and that he had pushed her around and she had called the police, as they had agreed together, the husband and wife had agreed together that she would call the police if he was violent. A single police officer arrived, and the husband went outdoors with a pistol, pointed it at the officer, and said, "I'm going to kill you if you don't kill me." And had his finger on the trigger. The police officer shot and killed him in front of his entire family. I talked to the widow a few days after his death, and the widow said, "I can't blame the police officer. I can really only keep him in my prayers that he does not feel that I blame him for the death of my husband." The hard part about this problem is every one of these situations is different. And to say, they make sort of the across the board explanations of Michael Connelly down in Salem doesn't match the same scenario as Michael Johnson up here in Portland.
Right.
And so this is why we need people who are smart and experienced to be involved in these conversations about police reform. And we don't have those at this point. We have a lot of inexperienced people, and we're just not there.
So we're burning out people. It is. I'm glad you brought it up, because I think that's always the narrative that we hear, and we had no choice. We had to shoot them. That's the narrative that comes out immediately after the shooting. Yeah. I think the public would have more trust in that narrative if it came out after a deliberate investigation. Right? Rather than 2 minutes after you've killed someone, well, we had no choice but to shoot him.
I think that was the comment of Daryl Turner within hours of the shooting of Michael Johnson.
Yes.
Daryl Turner is the union president for the Portland police officers. That he had finished his investigation.
Yes, he had. And in fact, his quote was, "Well, of course they had to shoot. They were in fear. Clearly they were in fear." And I'm like, he wasn't even at the scene, but he already has it figured out, and he has the analysis, which is what makes me so troubled by the medical examiner stating that the cause of death was suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that absolutely has to be challenged. And what's hard in these kind of incidents is that I saw Michael Johnson's parents on TV talking about his mental health issues and how they did everything that they could, and he was a good guy, and et cetera, et cetera. And it was as if that they had accepted that that it was somehow partially his fault that he was now dead. I don't want to argue with a grieving family,
no.
But at the same time, I think, Can we accept that as a society? Is that, are we going to say, well, okay, this guy had some mental health issues, so it was suicide? I mean, I don't want to accept that as a norm. And so this is the first time that I've noticed it, that when someone has been killed at the hands of the police, that the medical examiner ruled it a suicide. Now, and if that is just like normal practice, we have to change that, because we will never have the data on who's killed by the police if we're listing these deaths as suicides. It's not suicide. Nothing by their own hand made that happen. Back to the phone line.
Are you going to get some police on to talk about it from their point of view? Because I think you're going to find that what goes on is really not as rational as you're painting it to be. I mean, having been in a mental hospital myself, I can tell you that the thinking is disordered. It's distorted. And there's no way to rationally address that, okay?
Well, I mean, when we have animals that we are trying to move, wild animals that come into the city, we find ways. We use tranquilizer guns. We use nets. We have all kind of creative ways of actually being able to take that animal from point A to point B. Are you telling me we're not smart enough as humans to be able to do that for people?
I'm saying it's not smart enough. I'm saying you're using rationality to treat what's irrational. Okay, people who are in a
she
crisis.
Does that. You
know. And my ex-husband got into this situation where he was suicidal and I didn't recognize it. He was being provocative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we need to learn how to see mental illness the way we sort of, you've seen those bumper stickers, see motorcycles.
Right.
We need to learn how to see mental illness and interrupt this crisis long, long before it gets to the point where police involved. That's the trick, is we all need
to
elevate our understanding of each other and need to get more involved in each other's lives and more sensitive to that people might be feeling pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your call. And let me tell you, I invite police all the time, but most of them aren't brave enough to actually come on this program.
Yeah, it takes some guts. That's true. Thank you, Joanne.
Thank you. Have a good day. Appreciate the call. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Hello, John. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, this is Francis.
Hey, Francis. You're not John? How are you?
I don't know what happened. I think they were before me, but they're not there now.
It's all good.
Just today, they're showing a film from a couple of years ago, a young man, a 40-year-old man in Virginia, was being taken to the hospital because he was having a reaction to cocaine, and in the process was tasered, handcuffed and shackled, tasered 20 times.
Yeah.
And he died. And they're just now showing the video from 2 years ago.
Oh, yes.
And looking at that, it's really hard to see because there is no compassion, zero compassion. And when I hear people say someone committed suicide, it's like, okay, if you're having a suicidal episode, and so if you act crazy in front of the police, you know you're going to be killed. That's saying something about the police, not the individual. The individual knows that if they act crazy in front of the police, they're going to be killed. They shouldn't know that. That shouldn't be the case.
Right.
Yeah, it's not safe for people with mental illness to be in contact with the police at this point in Portland.
No, it is not. But the other thing that I really have a problem with, and I've said this many times, where young or African-American people are killed, and somehow it's being mushed into mental illness to where the fact that these police officers actually kill people like Keaton Otis and then somehow can put it on mental illness
really
bothers me a lot.
Well, I'm with you.
The thing that bothers me the most right now is the head of the FBI, I believe, came out and said the police are afraid that they're not doing their job as well as they should, and somehow it's because people are watching them.
Right. It's our fault.
And I can remember one time, I think it was during the discussions about the drug-free zones and how unconstitutional there were, and the police had their little rap sheet, and in that rap sheet, their newsletter, they referred to the constitutional concerns about these drug-free zones as constitutional gobbledygook. now that to me should indicate that an entire police department should be fired, because We require them
right.
to take an oath to uphold the Constitution. Why do we have them do that if it doesn't mean a darn thing?
Well, thank you so much for your call. Thank you. Appreciate you. Appreciate you staying connected and involved. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Hello, John. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. And a great program, very topical, especially for me, because I'm a old man now, and I'm diagnosed bipolar 2, and it took me a lot of years to at least get my mental health so I could function pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go downtown to, back in the 90s, to Mental Health Services West, which was Cascadia and subcontracted to Multnomah County. And in those days, we had a five-story building, and we had a lot of programs going. And that's when I think Clinton was in charge and a lot of Democrats. So we had money flowing
mm-hmm.
to Portland for a lot of programs. And by the way, Joanne, I agree with you on tranquilizer and nets.
Right. So here's the problem is today in Portland, if you call Mental Health Services West, now called Cascadia, for an intake appointment, you're going to get one, but it's going to be scheduled about 6 weeks out.
Mm. Oh, I believe it.
And that really means that we don't do crisis here.
Right.
If someone is in crisis, the mental health system is really not able to help them.
Right.
The system. And what people can do is two things, I think. One is take advantage of the emergency rooms. We still have emergency rooms here in Portland.
Right.
And you still can't. And it's a safe place to be, and you can get meds quick if you need them and certainly interrupt your crisis. But also, if you're thinking that you need the police or you need someone to come over, please don't call 911. Please call the Multnomah County Mental Health Hotline. It's 24 hours a day. It's staffed by real clinicians. They really can help. That number is 503-488-9888.
Thank you.
And that's a real help. That's real help to people.
Now, I'm going to post that on the website so folks will have that number. And this is the Multnomah County Mental Health Crisis Line?
Yeah, there was a city crisis line
right.
for some duration of time. I think Amanda didn't check with the county to see that they already had one up and running. But they've had it for years and years, and it's actually, if you call them and you really do need the police, they can patch you in and get a car over to see you.
You know, I'm
also I'd like to give excuse me for interrupting, but I'd like to give message out to veterans. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and finally I got into the VA system, and bring your discharge paper DD214.
Yeah, you got vets sitting here.
Don't hesitate and go to the office on the first floor of the main veterans hospital, and you'll get in, and it's a great program. And thank you, Kit Sopper and his days for the Oregon Health Plan, and then all the people that fought, mostly Democrats, fought for veterans' health care. Don't hesitate, because it gets dangerous out there. And I'm lucky; I'm mostly white. I've got some college on the GI Bill from the military, and thank you for the information on those phone numbers. That's wonderful.
Yes, it is.
Great work, folks.
Thank you,
John. That's a great message. Thanks so much for calling. Sometimes the hardest.
Please vote.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Often the hardest thing to do around getting well with mental illness is deciding to get some help.
Right, that's right.
And it is really the hardest part of the VA is getting in the front door.
Right.
So once you decide, you often get to that front door and it's closed. And it's very, very frustrating. But I assure you, from having walked a lot of people through that door, once you get through that door, things are good in there.
Help
you can get a lot of help.
Help is available. Well, I think this... both of these pieces of information are very vital, and this 24-hour mental health crisis line, 503-488-9888, is a relatively simple number to remember, which makes it a bit easier. But I before I go back to the phone line, I want to reiterate, you and I are in total agreement. If you're in mental health crisis, the last place you want to call is 911. You want to speak to and talk to a mental health professional. You do not want to have to be triaged by a police officer before you get treatment. So cut out the middleman who may actually be more damaging than help. Anyway, as we've been talking about with the cases that have taken place so far this year and continue the trend both locally and nationally. Back to the phone line. Hello, Eric. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Really great show. Thank you.
Thank you.
What I wanted to talk about is be sure of your diagnosis, too, because we're up until 2008, I was diagnosed as a borderline personality disorder, which is a death knell if you're getting a job or if it's out there
in the
cosmos. In 2008, I had an extensive neuropsych eval, and it was pointed out that I have Asperger's syndrome. And the thing is, there's some mimicking features of Asperger's that go blend into a borderline, but they're just understanding the spectrum of autism.
That is a huge area of curiosity for so many neuroscientists now. We're going to learn a lot more about autism, Asperger's, and all sorts of sensory perception disorders over the next decade.
Yes.
Correct. And that's why I do so well in the laboratory, because you give me an experiment and I go in the corner and do it.
You just got to find the right job for you.
Yep.
Well, I'm pretty close to a bachelor's degree in molecular biology.
Oh. Congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Who else do we have? Shane, good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, how are you?
Pretty fine. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm really good. I kind of chimed in late. Were we speaking of the gentleman that was shot by the police on 23rd Street or close to 23rd Street?
That's correct. Michael Johnson?
Okay. Well, my wife actually works for the hospital at Good Sam, and unfortunately, there are a lot of mentally ill people in this area that are seeking help.
Yes.
We hear a lot about the negativity of police. And it's more and more with all of everything happening. That's what everybody's focusing on, this negative aspect of police and how they are handling things. And they do so much positive, too, a lot more positive than what we're giving people credit for. And speaking of animals with using nets and tranquilizers, I get what you're saying, but animals don't walk down the street firing shots with handguns. The people here in the hospital were on lockdown, very scared. The people valet parking right here were witnessing this. This gentleman had a firearm. To protect and serve is what they do and what they have to do. And I think that we probably should give them a little more credit, saying they're afraid to call in. They're probably not allowed to call in. But we should give them a little bit more credit for what they do. They do a lot of positive. And unfortunately, they did what they felt was best for the citizens, and there's a lot of citizens out here that aren't carrying firearms and that aren't breaking the laws, and they have just as many rights as the people who are mentally ill. So I think we probably should start focusing more on the positive things the police do and less on negative, because without them, we all would be in a bad situation.
I actually disagree with you. I think the mass media does a great job of highlighting the good that police do. I think there's no lack of those human interest stories with the police, with the kids, et cetera, et cetera. I see them all the time. And so what I am doing is actually holding them accountable for the agreement that they signed with the Department of Justice, Civil Rights
Protect
Division, right? And making sure that what they said they were going to do, they're actually doing. And
right.
So here we are a year into the process, and we have the same number of mentally ill people killed by the police that we had the year before and the year before and the year before. And so I know some decent police officers. I have friends that are police officers. Doesn't mean I am not going to criticize when they are doing things that I think are inappropriate and they are not held accountable or to the same standards that you and I would be held to.
Well, sitting there, you know, versus people who are here, and I'm right now literally in front of the hospital, people who are here witness what was going on.
Right.
It was a lot different than you know, what you believe.
Oh, no, look, I understand you being concerned. I understand people in the hospital who are visiting or working there being fearful. Who would not be fearful of someone with a gun? But you and I aren't trained to intervene, and we haven't received additional training and resources to actually be able to de-escalate people who are in mental health crises. If right. I had that training, I probably would be able to utilize that training. I don't have it, right?
Okay,
but
I understand.
But we give it to the police.
So if me not having a mental problem, if I was walking down the street with a firearm, how would they handle me?
Well, I would think that they would do everything within their power, less than lethal force, to try to get you to cooperate with them.
They are trained to protect the public. If I was walking down the street firing a firearm, I would be handled the same way as somebody who's mentally ill.
Well, I appreciate your call and I appreciate your perspective. I really do. I was not there. I didn't watch it happen. So I appreciate you calling in.
Yeah, it's a challenging problem. How do you help these officers to reduce this number of deaths? All of the attempts of training by the police bureau to date
have failed,
and the right. settlement agreement to date, and we're only a year into this,
right.
Haven't reduced this number.
No.
And so the necessary trust between the public and the police hasn't been engendered,
yeah.
and that endangers both the police and people who are crazy walking around with a gun, and young kids walking home late at night after a football game.
Right.
It's just not a safe situation, and we're not on track to get it safe at this point. And that's the hub of our criticism, is mm-hmm. that we really want to make this safe for everyone,
mm-hmm.
including those officers, so they can go home safe at night. I really have sympathy for the wives of police officers who are concerned about this, but we can't let up.
Right. That's absolutely true. We are down to just a few minutes and a few callers. I think we might make this happen. Good morning, Sunny. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning, Joanne. And I was withholding my pledge out of protest briefly, but of course KBOO is important. And when I hear your voice and I see your efforts, I'm so happy to bring my pledge in.
Well,
so I'm out of protest.
Thank you, Sunny.
Well, thank you, Sunny. Yeah.
Then the other thing I'd like to say is these creepy cops don't do the good cops any favor. And let's admit it, that they are letting our democracy down, and they are acting differently. And there are a lot more cop shootings than there used to be. So let's not sweep it under the rug. Something is going on, and it's bad. Additionally, if you look at the recent case where the father and the autistic child, doesn't matter if the child was autistic, father and child were shot. The two officers are charged with second-degree murder. When you look up the YouTube or the news video footage, look hard. You'll see ritual markings on the ground. A pyramid has been drawn in the number 3. And then go to the book, which is very easy to read, called Ritual America. Ritual America. Many people are being killed kind of in a ritualistic fashion. Ritual America. It's the force of rather horrible, evil secret societies within the police element. Covert KKK or covert something else. But Ritual America covers a lot of them. It's easy to read, and the cops are definitely acting differently. Not all of them. And you know what I say? I say, God bless the good cops, and I do want them to go home to their wives and their husbands and their families. I want us all to be safe.
Yes.
That's not too much to ask. The cops are definitely, some of them, are definitely on another track than what this country wants them to be.
Thank you so much for your call, Sunny. We are out of time.
Thank you.
You're a perfect place to end. Thank you so much, Jason. I always appreciate having a conversation with you. I'm always stressed, and you're always so calm and so thoughtful, and I love that about you. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Look forward to our next interaction. This has been Voices from the Edge. I am Joanne Hardesty, and I will see you next week. Same time, same place, same station. And I want to say a special thank you to my fabulous engineer, Steve. He's just so fabulously wonderful. Thank you all. Have a great day. Bye now.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that bitter is gold.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Thursday, November 12th, in progress. And coming up in an hour, Air Cascadia will be off today, and instead we'll hear an hour of Flashpoints. It's investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 today, Between the Covers welcomes Portland.